Right, the date is December 14th, 2022, and the time is 9:36 a.m. And I'm calling to order the regular quarterly meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Property and Casualty Insurance Guarantee Association. Currently, we have 8 board members with 1 industry vacancy, and today we have all board members except for Mike Garrick in attendance, and so a quorum is present. TP Sigma staff in attendance is John Damato, Acting Executive Director, Annette Evans, Gary Vieira, and Stephanie Mendoza. We're also joined by TP Sigma's outside counsel, Shelby Betts. I think I said Annette Evans.
Yeah.
I was reading. And I'd like to remind everyone that we do have members of the industry who are competitors in the marketplace, and that we must all exercise care in avoiding any discussions that might give rise to an allegation of a violation of state or federal antitrust laws. Please speak up if you have any concerns in that regard. Item 2 of the agenda is the review and approval of the summaries of the official minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the summaries of the official minutes of the September 28, 2022 regular meeting of the Board of Directors and the November 30th, 2022 special meeting of the Board of Directors?
So moved.
I second.
Steve Polich moves. And Tiffany Reiner seconds. Is there any discussion or questions? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Is there any abstention or opposition? Hearing none, the motion passes unanimously. Item 3 is the executive session where we typically hear from the Texas Department of Insurance Office of Supervisory Interventions Oversight Report regarding troubled and insolvent property and casualty insurers. Shelby and John met with TDI earlier. They really did not have anything to report. And so we're not going to have that executive session today. Moving on to item number 4, the executive committee. Item number 1 there is honoring Marvin Kelly's service, and I'm really sorry that Marvin couldn't be with us today because I know we all have to acknowledge his 30 years of service to TP Sigma and his contributions, you know, to the National Insurance Guarantee Fund system. One of the things that I've had in the works for a little while, which I'll just let pass around, a draft resolution for the legislature just to acknowledge his service. And I'll just read it to y'all real quickly. Whereas Marvin Kelly retired as the executive director of the Texas Property and Casualty Insurance Guarantee Association on December 1st, 2022, after 30 years of service, drawing to close a notable career in insurance that has spanned over 4 decades. Whereas Mr. Kelly earned a bachelor's degree in insurance from the University of Hartford and a master's degree in business administration from Walden University. Whereas Mr. Kelly served in the U.S. Army Reserves, retiring as a major. Whereas Mr. Kelly has made numerous contributions to the insurance industry through his service on the National Conference of Insurance Guarantee Funds Board of Directors and as president of the Chartered Property Casualty Underwriter Society. Whereas Mr. Kelly helped to create programs at Houston Tillotson and Texas Southern University to educate students on career opportunities in the insurance industry. Whereas Mr. Kelly is the recipient of the 2022 National Conference of Insurance Guarantee Funds Gates Marchman Award in recognition of his longstanding commitment and service to the guarantee fund system. Whereas Mr. Kelly's dedication, professionalism, and expertise have greatly benefited the mission of the Texas Property and Casualty Insurance Guarantee Association, and he may indeed reflect with pride on a career well spent as he embarks on the next exciting chapter of his life. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the 88th Legislature of the State of Texas hereby congratulates Marvin Kelly on his retirement from the Texas Property and Casualty Insurance Guarantee Association and extend to him sincere best wishes for the future. And be it further resolved that an official copy of this resolution be prepared for Mr. Kelly as an expression of high regard by the Texas House of Representatives and Senate. And so I think anybody that has any dealings with the legislature knows that there's a huge logjam right before the session, so we don't have the actual resolution back, but I don't think it'll it'll deviate that much, but I truly am sorry that he wasn't here for us to wish him a fond farewell and good luck on his next endeavors.
Very nice, that's great.
Thanks. Well, this is really nice, I think. The House of Representatives and Senate.
They'll actually read that resolution to the floor, right? That's what I thought.
We'll see, there's a couple of different ways they can do it, so that's kind of still to be determined. But hopefully that's the way it can work out. The next two items are the draft of the board members' business ethics and conflicts of interest questionnaire and the draft employee work product and confidential information policy. Sent those out, drafts out before the last board meeting. I got a few comments in. We've incorporated that. I'm going to resend them. And if anybody has further comments on those, you know, we'll have a short window to get those in and to make more revisions. So I'll send y'all a red line version and then one with all the changes rolled in, and that we will take, hopefully take action on that at the March board meeting, or if we were to schedule a special board meeting sooner, we might take action then as well. But did anybody have any comments just that they wanted to share on that? So that will be, like I said.
I want to invite the board's attention to that. I think the draft code of business ethics and conflicts is a fundamental corporate governance document, and a lot of time has been spent on it. Hopefully, I mean, it's long, but it's intended to give meaningful, specific, practical advice on, you know, how everyone's supposed to behave and conduct themselves while doing TPCO business. And the other document was one that John had suggested about making sure that any, I don't know how much intellectual property has been developed by employees, but to the extent it is, it's their work product is the property of TPC, and they have to keep it confidential, that sort of thing. But if anybody has comments, they should get them to Joe Betsy.
Like I said, I'll be emailing you. Shelby and I had one more thing to go back over, and then I'll email that this week to y'all, the red line and the new draft with those changes rolled in. And then one thing, we did not notice it for this meeting, but one thing the executive committee is looking at still is possible legislation for the upcoming session. And I've had some conversations with people just to see how, what the package might look like and, you know, if we could really get it moving. I know one thing I think everybody would agree we need to do is work on the virtual meetings. And we've got the Life and Health Guarantee Association. I've got some draft legislation that kind of incorporates their language. We had talked about, there were a few issues that we might address with assessments just to clarify some things. And one thing that we're looking at potentially is just, you know, the situation we were in for this last property or other lines assessment. We ended up having to do that fourth quarter assessment, which nobody likes to get those at the end of the year. And that maybe we could just change that language, that you would just base it on the proportionate share of the most recent financial statements on file with TDI or something that would have allowed us just to do it first quarter, that you don't have to wait till the next financial statements are filed. And I think there may be another cleanup item or two on assessments. I think there is a gap insurance issue.
Yes, I mean, which is a kind of insurance that is tantamount to credit insurance. And Amber Walker, who's the in-house claims attorney at TPCGA, has drafted a compelling, reasoned legal opinion that gap insurance should be treated like credit insurance for purposes of applying the Guarantee Act, which would mean it's not covered. But this would just memorialize, you know, make it absolutely clear to, you know, to people that it is uncovered. So I think all of the things that Joe Betsy has described are, most of them are pretty surgical edits. They're not a lot of redrafting. It's just to clarify and make things easier to understand.
Have we received any claims for gap insurance?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
For the Western General, WGCI, we had a lot, and we had to deny some of them.
Okay, thank you.
And does it matter if it's like part of the auto policy or if it's a separate gap policy? Because there used to be, it used to be done, well, probably like three or four different ways, because the bank would actually sell some where there was a question whether that was even insurance or not. And then you had it where it was an endorsement to some auto policy. And then you also had a separate gap policy you could buy, so.
And they had both on this particular insolvency, where they were selling separate policies. They would give them to the dealership or whomever was selling the cars. So that some of them were separate policies and some of them were gap covered on the actual insurance deal. So we had them both ways under this.
So would it matter to us on how it was done, like whether it's endorsement to the auto or separate?
I don't think so. And you know, the legal issue would be, what is the specific insurance coverage you're talking about? And if it you know, is comparable to credit insurance, we're not looking for it.
And then it would be up to the receiver as he calculates the premium refund, whether or not, you know, that's going to be included or not, you know, not included. So
right.
He would take those out of the calculation.
Okay, so more to come on that. Next, we will move on to the nominating committee, and Mike Garrett couldn't join us today, so I think that one of the first item is really the slate of board officers for 2023. David, were you going to make a motion on Mike's behalf?
Yes, I would move that we unless we have somebody that has interest, but move that we maintain the officers that we currently have for 2023. Meaning Ms. Morton as chairman, Mr. Garrick as vice chairman, and Ms. Reiner as secretary treasurer, and myself as parliamentarian. I can't say it, so I can't do it.
So is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Steve Blaine seconds. Is there any discussion, any questions? All right, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposition or abstention? Hearing none, the motion carries unanimously.
Thank you.
The second item was filling the industry member vacancy, as y'all recall, one of the previous board meetings. We did submit a name to be considered by the Commissioner of Insurance. Well, we ran into a little technical difficulty in the way the statute's drafted, and this is something I probably should have mentioned when we were talking about potential legislation. And it says a full-time employee of a member insurer, which just the way stock companies are set up, they have some officers that may be, they're an employee of the holding company, but not a member insurer. But they're an officer of all the companies. Like Shelby was the general counsel for what? How many?
24 insurance companies. You know, when the statute was originally written, probably most insurance companies were mutual companies. And so there's just one company. And now with the proliferation of stock companies, especially if you have one more than one insurance company in your system, economies of scale are at issue, and they're not going to hire 24 general counsels, 24 actuaries, 24 chief accountants. It's a creative services company, and the person is a employee of the services company. But typically, I'm basing it off my own experience. I was an officer of every single insurance company, so my day was devoted to insurance at work. I was the functional equivalent of an employee, but technically not.
And so we're going to talk to the commissioner about it first, but we would just add employee or officer of a member insurer, just because we just happen to have a lot of mutual company representation on this board, but you don't want to just eliminate the possibility of a good candidate from that happens to work for a stock company from also being able to serve. So the nominating committee is going to go back to the drawing board and bring back another nominee to fill the vacancy created by Michelle Valady's resignation.
So one of the obstacles that we have run into in getting people to serve on the board is filling out that annual information, disclosures, et cetera. Is there any way we could put that for the legislature?
We have got that. We have a draft of that. That's going to be probably the heaviest lift, just doing away with that personal financial statement requirement. But we're going to have a replacement of something that we would file with the commissioner annually that would be more along the lines of what they should care about. That you meet the eligibility requirements and that you don't have conflicts of interest. And that it could be just, because really the personal financial statement doesn't tell them anything that they would need to know.
Yeah.
And it is onerous. And we've had several people that we contacted about service on the board from the industry. And I know there have even been some public members who, once they heard about the requirement,
they walk away.
That's it.
So you and I, we were in that chair.
Well, that's like Michelle served at one board meeting, and then the requirement came to file, and she's like, no, I can't do that, and left.
And I do want to emphasize, as Chair Norton said, it will be a very heavy lift. The Life Guarantee Association has tried to make inroads on this issue and has not been successful. But I told Joe Betsy, you know, in the drafting of the conflicts in the business conduct code before you, to me, that's what really should be focused on, because the personal financial statement really invades your financial privacy, in that you have to disclose all these financial holdings that have nothing to do with your service or TPC.
And then it becomes public.
Exactly. And so they ought to be more tailored. The requirement should be more tailored to your service. Bear in mind, it was first developed for legislators who make laws on everything under the sun, but your universe is a lot more narrow than that.
The way I looked at it, Steve and I had a conversation between the two of us as we were working on that, is that the first time is the hard time. Going forward, most of, for me anyway, most of it's going to be repetitive. So.
Well, now that it's automated and carries forward, yes, it's easier. Yes. It used to be paper and pen.
You started all over.
Yeah.
Scratch.
Yeah,
the first time it was not fun.
Yeah, it wasn't.
It's like, what?
It's a month you're not going to get back in your life.
So has there ever been consideration of like paying the public members some kind of amount for a meeting? The reason why I say that is because, like, TAPA, it's in their plan of operation. They have something that might help public members, you know, that decide whether to or not. I know it's self-serving because I'm a public member.
In the Guarantee Act, it says you don't get any compensation other than reimbursement for your travel.
I'm talking about changing that to where
Like a per diem or a per meeting.
Has it ever been considered try to run that trap?
No, but I can certainly ask about.
And the reason why I also say that too, when I was at the department, actually, we had a rule that we were working on that was going to recommend doing all the boards for public members like TAPA, because TAPA, they get $250 a meeting, but it got shot down for different reasons. But it wasn't self-serving at the time. You know,
so how long has TAPA, has that been long-standing?
Yes. Yeah, and that's what I was using as a basis, because I didn't, you know. And because we were having trouble at the time, too, as you can imagine, getting public members on the TWIA board. And, you know, it's a lot of work, to be quite honest. And when your food is good, I have to buy new clothes because of it. But I just was curious, has there been any on something like that?
Well, I didn't know there was any precedent. That's, is TAPA the only?
That I know of. Okay. And I hate to say that too, because I hate to be taken away from them, but you know, by, because sometimes a sleeping dog needs to, try to do.
You just poked the bear.
Right. And I'm on the deck for it. So I could be shooting myself in the foot.
Looking for a raise and you got cut.
Right. But I do think it would help all the boards get good quality public members is what I'm suggesting for.
And I think a good argument for that position, David, is how many months, years has it been for many of these positions not to be filled? I mean, it takes TDI a long time to find a qualified candidate.
Yes, well, certainly, TDI first.
Yes, no, thank you, yeah. Running traps is a good thing, but don't bring up Tampa, no.
Well, the precedent's what's kind of.
Right. Right.
Okay, the next, y'all have, I was gonna give this to, I don't know if you have.
Yeah.
Do you have that? And David, do you have, thing I sent out yesterday, just.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I don't think that, well, this is really just.
If not, I have to bring it up.
For sure.
Yeah.
Okay, this was just, for us to consider, it's possible resolutions from our, the HRC committee, the committee meeting that we had. So I guess I should state that for the record, we're moving on to item number five, the Human Resources Committee. So we did, the HRC committee did need to consider several items, dealing with, compensation and other, HR matters. The first one, we discussed was the salary merit pool. And just, by way of background, the last comprehensive review that we had of TP Sigga's salary administration program by an outside professional consulting firm, and it was a holistic top to bottom restructuring, recalibrating, was in 2013. And since then, the board and staff have attempted to update the side of the grid that was established in that salary administration program annually by considering data on employee compensation trends, which was on the grid shift, just to keep it in line, and then what we decided to do with the merit pool. And so it's the consensus of the HRC that it's now time for us to have another comprehensive review of the salary administration program to see if it's still appropriate to get any recommendations that they may have. And at this time, because we think that we need to have this this review, we're not recommending a grid shift this cycle, just because that could end up skewing some things, and we'll just see what the salary, what the consultants come back with, and then we can make adjustments there if need be.
So is there a timeline established for that?
No, but I think you will,
we did not.
I started on the wrong one.
We did some months ago when the topic started, maybe last year in 21. There was the firm that you all use, and I say you all because I wasn't here at the time. And we did get our hands on a proposal from that, one of the people that's part of that, was part of that group. So is that something you want me to recirculate to y'all?
Well, now we're going to go ahead and do an RFP.
Oh, good. Yeah.
So again, I'm sorry, because we're out of order and I didn't realize that. So, salary merit pool, Google, is the next item. So basically, by way of background, we think we need to do that. And so we're asking the board to authorize the HRC to craft an RFP. And if somebody from the HRC committee wants to make the actual motion, that would be great.
So I will make that motion. So I'll move that the board authorize the HRC to draft and issue a request for proposal for a compensation consulting firm to review and make recommendations regarding TP Sigma's salary administration plan. After determining the best proposal based on the grading criteria in the RFP, the HRC will make a recommendation to the board as to which firm to engage to conduct the review.
All right, is there a second?
Second
by Larry Rooney. Are there any questions, discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion carries unanimously. Steve Holt, you asked about the timing.
The timeline.
We'll try to do it as soon as possible. And if need be, we could have a quick, you know, telephone meeting or something if we need to have something approved. But, you know, hopefully we'll have something for consideration in March.
Okay.
I don't know. We had a little bit of trouble back in 2013 just because this is kind of a unique type of study and review. But I think we can get there.
Yeah.
I know some consultants that work more on the smaller side.
Right.
And then I think going back to the information that John said, that they got earlier this year.
And then the other thing that the committee might consider, since CIGF actually does a salary survey as well, that I'm sure that whatever firm you select will kind of lump into that too, or maybe consider that as well. One thing from a logistics standpoint to think about is if the meeting, you'll make some decisions at the Q1 23 meeting. Typically, we do merit and salary grid adjustments for the period 416 to 430, so the second paycheck in April.
So we're going to have a merit.
We'll
start with today.
That's right.
We're just not going to do the grid shift just because it might.
Sure.
We don't know if we're on the high end or not, and you have to move it up
that's great.
Now before we have the study, just
that's a good
in
idea.
Case we're right where we need to be.
What's the current plan of function of the work that was done back in 2013?
Mm-hmm. Just as it's been updated,
okay.
Right, when we've had the merit pool and then we would do the grid shift mm-hmm. that went along with that, just so that the salary bands kind of moved along. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And the reason that you don't do it every year is very expensive.
Right.
And in 2013, every single position was looked at, the job description, what should be the minimum point, the maximum point.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming something like this may, you know, it'll be the top to bottom.
A lot of industries kind of do it every 5 years. The ones I've been familiar with, and 10 years is too long.
And the other thing is too, like we looked at some, like the HR committee went back and looked at various insurance companies and where their grids were and all that. And we had some positions that were low and some that were high. And so we really need something that is, you know, for the industry that can tell us, okay, you're good here, you're way too low here, you're way too high here, and bring us back into consensus because it's been 8 years.
And it also it's difficult because again, we're a different animal.
Mm-hmm.
Not an insurance company, claims paying organization, but more of a nonprofit, quasi-governmental. It's just a unique animal just to find out exactly where those fit. But I mean, I think we're starting with a better starting place this time.
Yep.
Because the consultant was very critical of the one that had been in place before they redid it. And so hopefully this thing, I'm sure adjustments will be made for some positions.
And also for the benefit of the HRC as well, we made a practice this past year during performance review process to do a duty test for every position and rewrite every position where need be. So that way the job that someone's conducting matches up with the job description that they have, job grades and everything else. And we did have to make some adjustments. And one thing that our HR manager, Tatiana Bermudez, is really critical about is a whole duty test, making sure that, in particular, if we look at folks that are exempt and non-exempt, does that duty test make sense? So I think that whatever firm the committee selects for this exercise, they're going to have a pretty good package of at least our census of people, the job descriptions matching up in good form.
Well, I think in the short term, if you could send to the HRC members kind of what the job descriptions were from that 2013 study,
mm-hmm.
and then whatever the most recent review y'all had, because so we could do kind of a comparison.
We can do that.
Aligned with Steve's question, timing wise, we're not clean. It'd be nice to have, since we have an executive director opening,
right,
to have it in time for that. But there's no, realistically, we're not going to have.
I think it's going to be a while.
Yeah.
But you raise a good point. That might be worth looking at on an ad hoc basis.
Mm-hmm.
which could be short term.
Yeah, there's also, John, a discrepancy in what was in the board book and some of the meetings for the senior claims examiner position. In one place it's a job grade 7, in another it's a job grade 8. So in the actual HR, you know, description, everything it's a 7, but in the salary pool, it's listed as an 8.
Okay.
So that needs to be resolved as well.
Okay.
So as you're doing merit now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so let me make sure I'm back in the right order now. We've done that already. Okay, so now we move on to the 2023 salary merit pool. And so the HRC reviewed what other organizations, including member companies, were doing in terms of merit increases for 2023 and found that on average, most organizations were providing merit increases in the range of 3% to 4%. The HRC decided that a 4% merit pool seemed appropriate for next year, especially since TP City employees will be continuing to have a higher than usual workload given the recent influx of insolvency. And we are therefore going to recommend a 4% merit pool, and I'll ask for someone from the committee to make the formal resolution.
I'll make it.
Steve Flynn.
I move that TP City's 2023 operating budget be adjusted to include an allocation of funds for a merit pool that management may use in 2023 to provide merit increases for high-performing employees. The funds allocated to the merit pool shall be in the amount equal to 4% of the total budget for TP City employee salaries in 2022.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
David, are seconds? Are there any questions, any discussion?
Question, John, what was, I can't remember what the budget was for salary growth.
For salary growth, if we it's in the finance package. We initially in this budget included just a 3%, as was a
start. That's good enough.
So we'll need to just make an adjustment to that budget.
Well, it's 14.9 that included grid shift.
Right.
Yeah.
But the,
so we'll be amending that, and we're going to get to the finance portion.
Oh, right. Exactly.
Can I ask, does the merit pool cover promotions, or is that separate?
The merit pool does not cover promotions. To the extent that there's someone maybe in line for promotion, we'll, you know, recommend that in the budget and include it there, but it's not part
of that. So the 4% is a separate?
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we have a motion and a second. Is there any other question or discussion? Then all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any discussions or opposition? Hearing none, the motion carries unanimously. I think I already said this, but I'll just, we're now going in order, that we did decide to postpone the grid shift for 2023 until we had this compensation study and recommendations done. The next was the cost allocation of premiums for group health insurance benefits. And I think the committee felt strongly that we kind of needed to look at benefits holistically. And I know that John and our HR manager have been talking with the broker and are looking at trying to do some innovative things. Like, yes, we didn't move the term or the start date.
Right.
But that we're looking at the next go round would be effective July 1. And I think the HRC wants to collaborate with y'all just on some, maybe we've got some ideas for some innovations on ways to, and I think Tiffany was asking about health savings accounts.
Yep, health savings account. Looking at move to a single plan versus multiple plans, would that help with costs? Looking at just some various things like us making a contribution to the HSA.
That's right.
You know, on behalf of employees.
And then looking at maybe a transition period to get us out of the July 1.
18 months instead of
6 months.
Right. And a lot of what you're saying is stuff that has been quote unquote in our back pocket. Our anticipation was to move to a 1/1/23 renewal, but our policy experience has been poor. There's unfortunately been cancer patients and high cost pharmaceuticals. So we didn't want to make that plunge now because our rates would go up immediately. So we're just sticking with that policy, but the goal would be to perhaps do like an 18 month or a 6 month. HSA, given the types of plans we have, we actually don't have what's considered a high deductible plan. Our employees believe it to be a high deductible, but it's not your typical, you know, $10,000-$20,000 high deductible. So we don't qualify for an HSA. We have a flexible spending account, and that's a use or lose program. HSA, you can keep in perpetuity, pay your, you know, your Medicare Part D and do all that kind of stuff with it. We can't do that. Sharing in some of the FSA or giving a contribution would be very helpful. But one of the strategies, and I believe I shared it with Joe Betsy, is a reinsurance strategy where we would keep the policy, the plan design the same, but increase out of pocket. Say it goes from 5,000 to 10,000, but we have reinsurance for the portion from 5,000 and a dollar to 10,000, thereby increasing the level of co-insurance, but bringing the premium down. And the cost of the reinsurance is really cheap, because obviously it's not going to trigger for every employee.
I think if you're really close though to being qualifying for an HSA, I think co-pays is kind of the, like having going in doctor visit.
Yeah.
But if the board made a contribution in, that might change you over to an HSA.
Yeah.
So we'd be making that difference.
Yeah, there's if HRC wants to, and you know, we're having constant discussions with our broker. We flipped to three brokers now over the last year and a half. Current broker we're with is with the Elite Benefits, and they're based out of Houston and Miami, and they've come up with some great stuff. So if you want to be participative in some of those discussions too, that might get it right from the horse's mouth.
Sounds like there's enough just to have a special HRC meeting just on to discuss these. And I encourage the people that are on the HRC, if you've got some thoughts on other kind of innovation or just throw out, why don't y'all look into this so we can at least. Out of the box, in the box, whatever.
This is a major deal for all small employers.
Yeah.
I mean, it eats your lunch, and literally.
So and I bet the legislature is going to consider something about small employers in succession.
That would be good.
So
would the HRC be amenable to perhaps having this group come in and like present their thoughts so that we can have? You know, we can definitely do that, bring them on in for that special session you're going to have.
We could do virtual.
Yeah, no, exactly, yeah. But definitely could be virtual, Why did I say bring in this one? No, absolutely. We could work on that, too, so that would be
okay, cool. We'll follow up after. But like I said, we just think there's a lot of opportunity for collaboration, and we acknowledge that there's an issue out there, and we want to just find a...
Good.
You know, is there a set amount given to each employee for a FSA?
No, the FSA is a self-contribution. The way that we make it, we improve the process for the employee is this way. When they set up the FSA, they decide how much they want to put up to the legal limit, okay, to the max. I think the max might be $2,500. Yeah. So that's the max that they can put in, and it comes out of their paycheck. However, we fund the FSA on day one of the plan year, and the impact there is to help them cover those deductibles. So that way they will have the funds to actually pay if there's, you know, an 80-20 type situation where they need to pay.
Up to the amount they're contributing.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
But see, I'm ignorant about this. Can the employer contribute any part of that $2,500?
The max that can go in an FSA is $2,500.
But is it out of their paycheck?
It's out of their paycheck. It's pre-tax dollars.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay,
HSA is important.
As an employee, but an HSA has higher limits, the employer can contribute.
Yeah.
Because it falls under special guidelines.
But FSA, no. That's
And it's their money, but we advance them the money. That way, it'll just help them earlier in the year.
I get it.
Said another way, they don't have the full $2,500 until the end of the year. So.
My experience is one thing to absolutely avoid is self-insuring. You don't want to do that.
Yeah, we're too small.
I did that. It cost me $1 million.
Yeah, and you still have to have catastrophic insurance as part of that self-insurance plan anyway. Yeah. So,
but it's covering up to that catastrophic level.
Yeah.
It'll kill you.
No, it will kill you. Good.
All right. We will move on. The next item is the alternative compensation actions. And so,
who's on the phone?
Mike Garrett. Okay. He can't participate or come forward, but he's just wanted to listen. On the alternative compensation, it was the HRC's view that given the increased workload occasioned by the recent influx of insolvencies, it's appropriate in these special circumstances to communicate the board's appreciation for the staff's extra efforts. And the HRC is therefore recommending giving each employee a one-time payment of $500. The HRC is also recommending that these one-time payments be paid as soon as administratively practicable. And we did want to note that this ad hoc one-time payment should be considered by all to be a purely discretionary payment or action, and that there shouldn't be an expectation that this is going to be a routine thing going forward. This is something the board will look at, you know, when we look holistically at benefits and compensation on what to do. So does someone on the committee want to make a motion?
Can I make a comment over that? Mm-hmm. I mean, the idea here was, I think the board felt pretty strongly about looking at everything that Joe Betsy's talking about holistically, right? You just can't look at merit, you just can't look at, you know, you gotta look at everything, healthcare costs, and we're not there yet, there's work to be done. So in the interim, this was, you know, maybe a good option, especially given, you know, inflation running away and, you know, not really knowing where we're going with the grid. So this was kind of a way to recognize, you know, that, and that there's more to be done.
Is that a gross up payment, or is that $500 in taxes taken out?
It's a gross payment, so we...
So, a question of ignorance here, is there already a Christmas bonus or year-end bonus built in?
No. I'll let you guys get your motion, and then I'll make a comment.
I'll make the motion.
Thank you. What are you moving?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I, Steve Flynn, move that in appreciation of the staff's hard work and service to TV SIGA, at the time when insolvencies have been on the rise, the board authorized the interim executive director to provide, as promptly as administratively practicable, each TV SIGA employee with a one-time cash payment of $500.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Stephanie Reiner seconds.
And just for clarification, did you want to amend the budget for 2022 to
yes,
provide for this mm-hmm. amount?
Are we going to do that?
Yeah, we'll do it. I have to do it now as part of our Marriott to finance. Do you want to do it now?
Well, because in finance, you notice the 2023 budget.
Okay. I can move to that. Okay. So I move that.
Okay, so
I had one other question that I couldn't hear, but I think someone asked, is this a salary or taxes are taken out of it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, any other discussion or questions? Then all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition or abstention? Hearing none, the motion carries unanimously.
This is a kind of a staff question. What's the anticipation on how quickly, if that's the right word, is going to get
done? In light of this being something that is outside of something that they've ever collected, they are going to be so excited, and we can work through doing just an off-cycle payroll, so everybody can get the 500 less taxes like ASAP.
I mean, it's holiday season.
I can't tell you.
$500 for, you know, a surprise.
I can't tell you the number of employees that, I mean, some of our customer service folks, you know, earn $19 an hour. So getting a $500 bonus is just huge. And there's a number of folks. It's huge.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it warms my heart to hear that that's happening, because they are working very hard and they deserve it. And, you know, our hands are kind of tied in being able to do it. So I do appreciate the board taking that step, and they're all going to be thrilled.
All right, you want to make a question on the budget?
Yes. So we do not have anything left in the salary budget for 2022. So I will move to amend the 2022 salary line of the budget for, I believe, 44. Current employees?
40 right now.
Oh, 40?
Yeah.
Okay, so $20,000 to cover $500 bonuses for each employee.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Mark Tatey's second. Any questions or discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition or abstention? Hearing none, the motion carries unanimously. Okay. Item five is compensation of the interim executive director. That's an item that we'll be talking about in executive session. And then take some action in open session after that. The search for the permanent executive director. I think I really appreciate all the board, especially some new board members that really wanted to make sure that we do have this robust search to find the best candidate. We know we have one internal candidate and we've had some interest expressed from two external candidates so far. But the HRC will be getting together soon to consider candidates and start some interviews on that. And we will report back. And depending on the timeline, we may have to have a special meeting of the board between now and March to take some action there.
Is it the HRC's intent that the entire board be involved in final interview?
I think that's going to be up to the board members, but I think we'll do the initial round and then we would encourage involvement from anybody that wants to be. And we can try to do it, whether it's some sort of a group or, you know, individual, just to see y'all schedules. Because I think everybody brings something different to the interview process. So this is probably the biggest and most important decision the board will make.
Absolutely.
Right?
That's what I said at our special meeting.
So we do want to make sure that the whole board feels pretty, is a part of that.
And that's a good question, Steve. I think we should get our arms around that. I mean, sometimes when there's a subcommittee, I'll just make up numbers, just start with 10 people, we get down to 3 or 4. And at that point, it's kind of the finalist list, and you bring in the whole board, that's one option. Certainly there's others.
Okay. Maybe not. I wouldn't call it an interview, but at least an opportunity to meet and general discussion.
Larry Jensen.
Yeah, I just wanted someone to refresh my memory of how was this disseminated, that there's this position open?
We're continuing to disseminate, but some of it was just through industry contacts. I think we are going to go ahead and submit it to NCIGF. Just, I don't know that somebody coming from another state, but there, and then just on some of the ZipRecruiter type things, just to put it out in there. And if somebody has some other ideas that would be beyond that, please share. But I think there was some folks, I think, care about the organization and have tried to find some qualified candidates to send our way. So that's been very helpful. Okay, well, that's it for the HRC, so we're moving on to the Claims Committee, and Mark T, take it away.
All right, for the third quarter, we did see a slight decrease in claims, but we are seeing an uptick. We've had two new insolvencies since our last board meeting, Weston Property Casualty and FedNet. Both of those are out of Florida, so those are both Florida insolvencies. Weston did have a high volume of unearned premium processing has been pretty much completed, but we are watching Florida situation to see if we are going to have any additional insolvencies there, obviously with the hurricane impact that they have there. And outside of that, I was going to hand it off to Matt to give some more detailed summary of.
I'm coming over here so you all don't have to.
But yeah, like Mark said, we've had we're having right now an increase in claim count with FedNat and Weston turning in their claims. We are decreasing in the other areas, the auto ones that we had on file. So right now we are having around 7,500 claims. And at the end of the quarter, it was about 7,000. So they're still going up with our most recent insolvency, FedNat. I believe they had some, which I'll touch on a little bit later, they had some company mergers and assumptions
And so some claims, they're having trouble getting claims to us because out of all the three or four companies, they use five or six different claims vendors. So they're still trying to collect all of this claims data, and they're sending it to us sporadically. So if you get any, I wouldn't say complaints, because that's such an ugly word. If you get any inquiries from the public.
Opportunity.
Yes, about why I haven't had my billing yet, it's because the receiver is really having trouble contacting all these different vendors and getting us claims information. So, you know, we'll get 200 claims here, 300 claims here, 500 claims there. So they're coming in when they can get them. So the claims count is kind of always up in the air. Unearned premium, we've gotten most of the lighthouses paid. And I'll go over some numbers on there a little bit later. Now we're getting Weston's in. I think we've gotten maybe close to 19,000. Expecting that they had 30,000 policies when the insolvency was first announced. Some of those policies retired before the policy expiration dates. So we're expecting a little bit over 20,000 on Weston. Fed not so much with the assumptions and mergers that happened before then. We're only expecting a few thousand earned premium claims on that one. So staff is actually increased a little from 75 to 85 from the second to third quarter. It's going down in one area, the auto claims ones that we've been handling it. Attrition has been taking care of some of that. We've not been replacing in that area, but we have had to replace some of the property insolvencies that we've gotten. So we're still keeping an eye on that. We still are collecting money back, recoveries from net worth, mostly. On the workers' comp claims, we've collected over $334,000 this last quarter. And the big piece is we're shaving money off of medical expenses. We were billed over $8.5 million this last quarter, and we were able to save $6.7 million of that in just savings, customary charges, cutting it down. So we ended up paying out only 1.8 of that $8.5 million that was billed to us. That was over 76% savings on that.
That's fabulous.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah, that's good. We're doing RFPs to make sure we have the right companies still in place to help us with that and some of the Medicare funding, so we're keeping on top of that. Claims staff, like I said, is decreasing a little bit. So quarterly, anybody have any questions on that? I can't really say what the next quarter's going to look like. I do think personally, we're still going to get some more insolvencies next year out of Florida specifically, so we have to be trying to handle those. We're trying to learn from each insolvency. We haven't had this big number of residential insolvencies in a while, so there's a lot to learn from this one. Hopefully, we don't get another multi-unit one like we did for customers who were around for ANCAP. And by the way, so basically, we had checks totaling $1.4 million. You signed it.
Yeah.
That was a big one.
Yeah.
You know, the claim count wasn't huge, the dollars spent on it was huge. So. As far as the individual insolvencies, we're following up on a few of them. We have several of them, of course, but we're following up on about six or seven of them. The ACCC was the last big auto one we had. We ended up getting 9,000. Claims have about 3,500 pending. Probably about 2,000 of those are in litigation or headed that way. Statute dates are running. Attorneys are filing suit to protect statutes. So these are the last of the claims that's hanging around. Bedivere was a workers' comp and environmental one. It was not a very large one. We were able to get rid of all of the environmental claims, my business, just the workers' comp was pinned. AMCAP was the one who was talking about that, was the multi-unit apartment buildings, all of those commercial residential insolvency, and we were finally weaving that one down to. It had 786 claims and under 100 of them pending, but like I said, one of them could be $1.4 million, and that's just the ACD, the payment that we make it first, And then there's a recoverable depreciation portion that's going to be $900,000. So just one claim has a big impact on that. And then Western General, that one was kind of going down, although we did get new claims on that one this month. That was a commercial auto, just regular substandard auto out of California. Got 381 claims and we had a little over 50 pending. I thought that that one was kind of going away, but like I said, we got new claims on that one this month. Excess home was another single family that we had out of Louisiana. It was a small one thing, you know, it wasn't very large. Lighthouse is one of the ones that were still really hot and active. That was from April of this year. We were expecting, they told us to expect 358 claims. We've got over 1,300 so far. Almost 1,000 of them are still pending. And this is the one where we paid almost 21,000 on our premium claim for a little over $20 million. So that one was one of our first big ones. And keep in mind, you know, TBC isn't used to paying 20,000 on our premium claim on one insolvency. But on top of this one and then the next one, Weston, which is going to be at least 70 policies, if not a little more. You know, our printers and check writers are smoking, blowing up because they're going fast and furious. If you do get any problems, we used to only take payments Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and kind of like at a leisurely pace. That's when we printed checks, but we're having to print them every day and do several printings a day so that they can get, you know, this money out. As we're talking to Gary, IT is involved in all of this finance. You know, it takes a village to run TBC. But, you know, we're constantly getting emails from clients end of the year. You know, they have to pay their house insurance and then when it's all, so now they have to have insurance for the mortgage company, so they had to pay a second one. And it's Christmas, so everybody's wanting their premium payments in, and we're trying to, fast and furious, trying to get them out, but it doesn't always work this way. So telling Garrett, I get several emails a day. He sends them to me, and I respond to them when I can. I get, you know, phone, voice messages. And today, I started getting texts from customers. I'm on Social Security, and I can't afford it. So they try to hit us in every direction, so we're trying to get them as soon as possible. Weston, like I said, is the next one. It was a residential one out of Florida. I think we've received so far almost about 19,000 UEP records. We've probably paid 16,000 of them almost. We're working on probably about another 1,000 right now to pay. So we're trying to get those done. And then FedNat, or Federated National Insurance Company, also out of Florida. We have started getting those claims in, we've gotten some hardship on our premium claims in. We paid them, but for the most part, they had a company take some of their claims away. Monarch, they had another company kind of assume some claims. It's different legal terms that they have to do. Some of them took the claims with them, some of them didn't. Ended up, we'll only be responsible probably for Federated National and this insurance company, Maison, which was another affiliated company that they merged with. And the policy count on that won't be too large. The claim count will probably be just as many as Weston. I think we've probably gotten 700 or 800 claims in by now, and they're just starting to come in. So, that one won't be big, but it's slow mover. I think that when we had our clients meeting, it was a little bit up in the air, just to let you know, not everything is so black and white. Weston, the one that we got with 21,000 policies, ended up after we got the claims, found out they were selling, policies were coming in with all different insurance company names on them. So we had to kind of slow down the process to see if they were all included in the insolvency. And I think so far we've got a handle on that. We've been able to resume at the table, so there shouldn't be any delays. Any questions about claims at all?
Yeah, we appreciate what you do, and she does get some cranky.
Yeah, we do, but I'm trying to, we understand that, we also do. All right, thank you.
Just a quick add to that, I got a call from time to time, I'll get, you know, voicemails or calls, and I got what seemingly was an irate policy holder, and he was just kind of rough and tough on the call, and he said, you know, they took my premium, I need it back, if you don't, if y'all don't get back to me, I'm gonna have to file a theft report. It was with Weston, yada, yada, yada. So I'm prepared to call him, just letting him know what the process is. And so I told him who I was and wanted to go through the process. He goes, time out. And I thought, oh God, what's he gonna say? And he said, I've talked to someone else in customer service. He said, you know, there's 20,000 other people in the same situation. So he said, I'm good. He goes, thank you for everything you all have done. I was like, wow. I was ready to go to war with this guy, but he was just like, relax, man, relax. So it was good.
You were thinking I got 19,999 more calls.
They he was surprised to find out he was a very special snowflake.
And that's it from that.
Okay. Is somebody okay now, or do y'all need a quick break?
All right.
Okay.
One minute.
Sure, sure. So we're going. Okay. Oh, we are. Okay. The time's now 10:45, and we are back on the record from the 10-minute break, and we'll move on to item number six, the claims. The finance item number seven, the Finance and Audit Committee, and Tiffany Ryan.
All right. So we have a couple of items today, and we'll start off with the 2023 draft budget. So in your book in tab A is the 2023 proposed budget as compared to 2022. I'm going to ask you not to look at salaries because we need to amend that from our discussion earlier today. So there was just a placeholder put in here that was presented to the Finance and Audit Committee. And we said that when the HR committee made the recommendation, we would come back and amend it to whatever that recommendation was. So just going through this, you know, kind of line by line a little bit, there is a FICA tax increase, you know, based upon salary increases that will get adjusted as well for the decision that was made earlier. Employee insurance, I think this is where, you know, to be honest, it's an educated guess of what is going to happen on a 7-1. We don't know yet because there's a lot of decisions that still need to be made as to our insurance programs, what the contributions will be, will we change the structure, etc. So for the moment, we have a 12% increase in the budget for next year. Again, that is for 7-1 to 12/31. So if you annualize that, you're really, you know, looking at an employee insurance cost increase to TPC of 24%. Okay. Retirement and other benefits, this will also be adjusted due to the decision from the HRC earlier today, based on what the new salaries will be after merit. Education as well as travel, I think we all know that's, you're doing more in person now. There'll be a lot more conferences, and I'm sure John and Annette and others will be attending throughout 2023. Contract labor and consulting fees, again, these are always educated guesses based on what we know as of today. You know, we've heard Annette say, for example, we might have a few more insolvencies, which I fully expect, just, you know, in general. So we are, you know, including this in here. The consulting fees, also there's a big increase in there. We do want to do the HR consulting, other things as well. So audit fees, this is based upon our audits that we have planned. And John, I do want to confirm with you that this does include the actual amount for what we just did the RFP in our new audit partner.
This was pre-receiving the final engagement letter, so we will adjust that accordingly. It's gonna be pretty close to what we had as a placeholder, but we'll make it correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, again, we had a major increase in our cyber liability policy this year. We have that claim, so that claim falls off. we're subject to it because of the findings for the rates, so that's included.
Can I ask one question on insurance, since you just hit that?
Yeah.
So in looking at between the 2022 and 2023 budget, the line item for insurance for that commercial auto, property, crime, fidelity, EDP, and umbrella, it went up by $6,500 from 9,500 to 16,000. Is there a particular policy that caused that?
Well, the lion's share of the increase was on the cyber.
And that's a separate line item.
Yeah, a separate line. Can you repeat that line again, Joe Benson?
It just says commercial auto, property, crime, fidelity, EDP, and umbrella. And in 2022, it was 9,500 and then it's 16,000. And I just wondered if there's another line that we're seeing really escalating costs.
Yeah, I'd have to go do the side-by-side on the policy, but we can do that. Follow up on what it was. Yeah, it doesn't come to mind why. I think it was just really a general adjustment. Keeping up with what the market was, and that's where a broker could come up with. But I can look at a side-by-side.
Yeah, I should know if there's another line that was...
Did you have a big claim?
Yeah, that's what they were.
Well, that was on the side of it, not on the...
Right, well, that was definitely not...
Not on this one, yeah. This is different policy, yeah.
And to be honest, it didn't really catch my eye, only because
costs are rising.
Costs are through the roof, and I don't know if anyone's gotten their homeowner premium lately, but...
Yes.
46% increase.
Time to shop.
I don't see it in here, so watch your back.
That's fine. I have a couple of them. When you get down here, so I just have a couple of other line of questions.
Absolutely.
I'm not criticizing, but I'm just curious.
Mm-hmm. We're good. Yeah. Well, let me get back to that page. Okay, so we'll be preparing the office next year for relocation. So there's some increased costs associated with that.
I did have a question about that, though. So what if we're not relocating until like third quarter 2024, what are we going to do?
So
like $32,000 worth of preparing?
Some of that's going to be working with the broker and plan design, like organizational design of what we're going to need. We've already gone through a fair amount of analysis of what our square footage needs will be in offices and all that kind of stuff. And they can kind of put some of that together. But we're going to have a fair amount at the end of 23 in preparation thereof, because technically, we probably have to be confirmed with a move by mid-24.
So should this be in the 24 budget then, John, instead of 23?
Pieces of it could. We could split the difference and maybe just split it in half, because there will be some consulting type fees we're going to need to go through as far as architectural design and all that.
So have y'all found the property?
Not yet. And there is a very small possibility that we can exit this lease earlier, and that was part of our framework for including some of the dollars, because the management company has a sort of interest, and if they do find someone to take this over, then we can move it sooner. Again, nothing definitive because there's so much available space. Mm-hmm. This is a unique property in that, you know, it's worked out for us having one entity in this one building that can be, how do you say, subdivided and such.
With a lot of commercial space opening up, do you see that helping out at all with the cost per square foot?
Yeah, I mean, what we're paying right now, when I first joined and I saw what lease was put together, not only was it put in for too long a duration, 10 years is far too long, but we're going to do much better. Cost per foot by all means. And you know, there's no, if you move in such a way that enables you to be resilient to move 3 years later, I mean, you could do that too. I mean, we're in a paperless society here, so you know I wouldn't encourage setting up a lease any more than 3 to 5 years
with options
to renew, of course. All that space downtown that Meta was going to use for Facebook is now being sublet. They're not using it. They built it all out. They built the building. And they're not using it. It's empty.
Yeah, but nobody could have predicted the pandemic and going remote, hybrid.
Yeah, and there's a lot.
Do you have space in your building? Because Miller's kind of great. You know, there's Kirby Lane right at the bottom of your building. I love Kirby Lane.
Well, I guess my question then is, like, we have 29 more increase in here. Do we really need that?
Part of the reason why it's in there is if we do have that opportunity to move sooner, we can pull it. And if we pull it and then we have to request an amendment because we are having the ability, we can do that if that's fine with you all.
I would say we put it in 24, just because that's when our lease ends.
Yeah.
And then we're expected to move. And we can always do an amendment if we want to exit our lease early.
So that's line 15.
Computer systems, we do have some planned changes that Gary will talk about.
Yes.
Here, but there is some cost associated with that. So we have a claim systems conversion as well as some just in general computer increases for services and stuff like that. So those are the main items, but in total, you can see it does come out to a pretty large increase that is going to change substantially when a salary change is made, which trickles through to FICA, you know, and other unemployment taxes, etc. So I would open this up for any questions first. I need to make a motion to pass the budget with some amendments.
So, if we want to ask some questions, just those line items.
Yep.
So I have a question on in the executive budget for the legal fees, which is a whatever item in the line.
Yeah,
let me go back to.
For the actual budget.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in 2022, we had budgeted $70,000.
You talking legal fees?
Mm-hmm. Legal fees. Yeah, and then we showed the actuals are $92,675, and so it raised to $85,000. Mm-hmm. So I thought this line item was really just Shelby's retainer. And so what I was just wanting to know what, you know, caused the actuals. Would it be like the HR attorney you had to hire, or?
That would be part of that.
But this, was supposed to be just, you know, outside counsel, general and administrative legal services.
Right. That was the other part of it, that's right.
But the related question was then under consulting, under HR, you have legal HR consulting fees.
And so we've included those from a budget perspective. They didn't exist before because we're down to one person in HR. You know, we had an HR director and a coordinator, and the coordinator was let go. So from a budget standpoint, to the extent we needed some heavy lifting, now we're in the midst of a conversion. HR was all paper, and there was no automated HR system, HRIS, technically speaking. So we had to digitize files, so we did have some temporary help in there. This year in preparation thereof, and we're adding a module from our general ledger, our Dynamics general ledger in HR that's going to provide for that.
But that's more under the contract labor or not, right?
Well, we included it with consulting in HR. It's more just how you want to classify it. You could reclass it out of HR into contract labor, but we thought to leave it in HR because it was an HR function.
Well, this is HR. Line item A, contract labor, human resources.
Okay.
Special projects, HR file compliance.
Oh, versus consulting, you're saying.
This is legal HR consulting. So I'm wondering why, I'm just trying to make sure that we need to
have it both.
I'm just trying to, yeah.
Okay. I'll look at the genesis of that. And why it's there, I can't really answer it right now.
And then the compensation and benefit survey is not what we're talking about doing. We're going to come back once we get people to find the RFPs.
Well, then what is that?
It's the $10,000 line item that says compensation and benefit survey, which is, I know that what we're going to commission is going to be more than that.
Yes. Yeah, so we can. We can, should we strip that for now and then just do an amendment? We can do that.
Where do you see that? Where's that?
It's gonna be in the, it's gonna be in the departmental budgets.
Behind tab A.
Yeah, and there, what page?
58.
Okay.
Yeah, 58, yep.
So I feel like it should be broken out, like the 20,000 we have for the consulting fees, if that's really contract labor.
Yeah.
Then I would put it under the contract labor in the HR. And then the benefit survey, we know is gonna be more than that. Do you want to amend that now or do we wanna wait and see?
No, I'm just pointing it out, because like we've got $30,000 for this contract labor in HR. It sounds like general file and administrative help. Then you've got $20,000 for legal HR consulting fees, which is new. And then the compensation and benefit survey. I'll just make, try to make sure that we weren't duplicating.
Yeah, it's just kind of, why wouldn't you put the leave if it's, leave if you're, if it's a law firm, why doesn't that go in one bucket?
We can do that.
I mean, but it's,
All right, so I say we put all the legal stuff in the legal bucket.
Yeah, that's good.
And then all the, any contract labor should be in the contract labor line, lines 8.
Then I'll have one more question and then I'm done. So under leasehold improvements, which is item 12, under planning of business services, which is on page 27. My question was on the two document shredding charges. I mean, it's really nitpicky, but you've got monthly document shredding that totals $3,600, and then you also have quarterly document shredding, which I would have thought would have been consumed with the monthly.
Yeah, so we, there never was a, there was never a proper document retention and destruction process. It existed, but it never happened. So a lot of documents that should have been destroyed never were. And so last year, we went through an exercise to go through that. So what we're seeing on that represents that heavy lift. The normal recycling is there. Then there's those heavy lift components where they're literally, documents are taken away in boxes, and literally that destruction they do is at the box level. So they come and pick the boxes up from the file room, stuff that's ready for destruction. So we did go through a very labor-intensive process to make sure all that stuff was, how do you say, staged for destruction.
But is that stuff that is?
It's timed out with statute and the like, as far as duration of time to hold and.
So that's more document destruction, like our retention policy has expired, we can now get rid of these things.
And we had to add it in because it never had been done.
But the regular document shredding is the personal information from claims or wherever it is.
Just like your normal course of business, you know, your.
You'll have like a box that you just put documents in, they can pick it up.
Yeah, there's that.
So do you have any exposure from not, you said it was never done. We had a policy and it was never being completed.
Well, I can't remember when this was and that, but I think you have, you and I worked together on the policy retention, you know, the document retention policy that had not been looked at for a while. And I think they, the reason that happened is because image rights started getting clogged up and people recognized, wait a minute, we've got these boxes, you know, image right is clogged, we need to make sure that it's, we're getting rid of this stuff. And so I guess if you can't do it in one day, you gotta do it over time.
Yeah.
So I guess, is there any sense of how long these, the big lift is the quarterly, right?
Yeah.
So, well, so 10 years, 3 years?
Well, so annually, we have an annual review and destruction period in place. So in February, the first, you know, was the big lift.
Okay.
Wasn't always, it wasn't after surely, I don't know how long it's not been done consistently and thoroughly. I'm sure some things were discarded. But it wasn't all able to be done in this 15
day review period this year. Next year, it'll be better, and we do have some off-site storage that we didn't get to, that we also need to go there and destroy some units, so that it's in the budget again for this year. This, yeah, I feel it's appropriate because we have two different off-site storage areas that we have to look and see if destruction orders are in place statutorily or with not with the orders that the receivers put in with the courts, and we can destroy them now. We need to go in there and destroy them, or we need to scan them into InDrive and then destroy them, however that reads. But there is a lot to catch up on.
Okay.
Tiffany, to your question, I don't think we get in trouble for holding them longer. It's more about the intention that we have to keep them for that period of time.
Yes, right? I think I was more worried that we just weren't destroying them and we were discarding them.
No.
Oh, no, they're destroyed.
From a legal, I'm not a lawyer, but from a legal standpoint, if you have the documents, despite having a structured policy, you're still on the hook. And lots of companies, and I mean, you even mentioned it yourself, Tiffany, you were looking for an email and said, oh, it went to the auto destroyed, it's not there anymore. Yeah. Lots of firms do that. They purge emails.
To me, the big problem with keeping them too long is you're in litigation.
Yeah.
You're doing discovery requests, search all your files for this. And it's like, oh my goodness.
If we don't have them.
If we don't have them. Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm good. That was really, I just had an inquiring minds kind of question.
So there's some requests.
Yeah.
So I think we have several things here. So one, so we do need to pass a 2023 budget today. But there needs to be several amendments to it. So, Shelby, I was going to make a motion to pass the budget and then list out what those amendments should be.
Sounds good.
Okay. I'll add in the move to contract. So I'll forget that one.
I just had a couple of other questions, too. One was the salaries in the executive. Was there any adjustment made for the position really not being filled or estimating what to do? CEO's salary might be. Was there any adjustment made?
Yeah. I think we'll adjust if needed when we do the study and someone's hired.
Yeah, you can make it an amendment to the budget during calendar year
2023. Okay. And then the other, Tiffany, was just kind of back on the consulting fees. I know the adjusters went up from 41 to 51, I think, in December to handle the excess claims. And I was just wondering if it's really prudent at this point, knowing there's likely to be other insolvencies coming, to just cut that. I know it's not big dollars, but just cutting it in half would be more prudent.
This doesn't affect the contract adjusters.
So the way the claim process works with contract adjusters and the actual claim dollars and the loss adjustment expense, which would be our contractors, it's not coming out of our operating budget. So this would just be like our administrative operation versus our claim operation.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. I guess I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's a great way to do it, but once you understand it, it makes sense.
Well, it's an important concept to understand. Yeah. There's a second budget for the claims operation. This is the overhead. Yeah. The full-time employees. So, and of course, under the statute, we put in proof, or TPC that puts in a proof of claim for all of its expenses for adjusting, covered claims for that insolvency. Sadly, it doesn't get paid 100% usually because there's not enough assets in the till. But the first person to get paid is the receiver's expenses, and then the second is the TPC.
So those adjusting the expenses to hire those are paid by the estate if there's money there.
Gotcha. So this line contract labor is something?
It's more on that department. Like we had contract labor, in this case it was human for human resources that we had to protect.
It's like 10th employees.
Yeah.
X claim.
Right.
to do overhead types of jobs, not adjusting claims for cover.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, so I'm going to try and do this because there's several changes here. So I'm going to make a motion to approve the 2023 proposed budget with the following amendments. Lines 1, 2, 3, and 5, which are salaries, FICA taxes, unemployment taxes, and retirement and other benefits, be adjusted to the 4% merit pool that was approved earlier. Also, I'm removing the $29,400 in leasehold improvements from the 2023 budget to the 2024 budget. And then also breaking out the temporary expense into the contract labor line 8. So with those adjustments, we will still have an increase in the overall 2023 budget as proposed to the 2023 actuals. However, it will be significantly less than what you do see there.
Okay. And did you want to put legal in all one spot? Or?
Well, I think that leaves legal. When we're breaking everything else out from the legal, we're going to contract.
Yeah. Okay. So it'll be illegal under human resources.
Yeah, all legal fees should be under legal.
Yep, agreed.
Yes. So,
under the executive. I mean, it's
underlined.
The underlined item 9.
And I think you might want to have a catch-all, and the revised budget shall be reviewed by the chair of the finance committee to assure that these amendments have been made consistent with the discussion. I mean, this is kind of
okay.
You know, all these. Amendments are ad hoc.
Strike that one. Pretend I never said a word.
Take this part of
it. We're going to try again. Okay. All right. So we're going to motion to approve the 2023 budget with the following amendments. Lines 1, 2, 3, and 5, which are salaries, FICA taxes, unemployment taxes, retirement and other benefits to be adjusted to the 4%. That was presented and approved today in our meeting, as well as amending the contract labor to break out all temporary expenses and to also include all legal fees in line item 9, and then move all leasehold improvements from the 2023 budget of $29,400 to the 2024 budget. Once these amendments are made to the budget, it will be reviewed by the chair of the Finance and Audit Committee and published to the board.
Is there a second?
Hold on.
Steve Lynn seconds. Are there questions, additional discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition or abstention? Hearing none, the motion carries unanimously.
All right. On to our second item.
Can I just ask a question? Do you see, because we're talking budget, do you need to formally make the amendment to the 22 budget for the one time?
She did.
Oh,
you did.
Oh, you did.
There was that.
Right. That break messed me up. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. No, we're good. 2022 annual audit plan. So I think everybody was in attendance at our meeting on November 29th. It was
30,
excuse me, where we did appoint Thomas Howell and Ferguson as our new audit partner. John has notified everyone who did not get the audit for next year, and Thomas Howell Ferguson is now has been engaged and is working with John, on that. There's no additional motions here to make or anything. We have approved all of the items to be reviewed by in the audit plan for next year, but it's just that we're reviewed for it.
Well, there's a motion to for John to write a letter to the TDI consistent with that regulation requiring the audit plan to be filed.
He's got it. Okay, I don't have that.
It's the last sentence in there, but I have it. I'll get it off to them. It just articulates who we've appointed for this year, the agreed upon procedures, engagement letters, et cetera.
Yeah.
That's a byproduct of one.
And I would include too, because the reg says you should consider any, you know, audits that are appropriate, which the finance committee, not a committee, did. And you just finished a fraud targeted audit and there wasn't any other.
That's for you.
Oh, okay. I would just say you, other.
Number four is in there.
Okay. Yes, thank you. Done it. And this is just required by that reg that says you must have an audit. You must change your auditor every 7 years. And when you, when the audit committee meets, you've got to consider other audits to see if they're, and their finance did that. There weren't other audits that were needed.
Okay. So I will present a motion to approve the audit plan to engage Thomas Hal Ferguson. John will file with TDI. This plan will be approved audit with the audit to be completed by April 30th of next year.
Is there a second?
A second.
Steve Holt seconds. Any questions, any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition or abstention? Hearing none, the motion carries unanimously.
There he is on.
Thank you, Tiffany. Okay, I'm gonna have everybody look at attachment C. Really quick. Just to go over a couple, just three things that we did here this past quarter for IT. One of the main ones, big one was we had an image right upgrade, image right, we kind of talked about it, is our workflow and trainings management system. We actually had planned to do this next year, just so you know, but Microsoft, in their wisdom, decided we were going to change security parameters for Office 365. I'm not going to get too technical. But basically, that would have broken some of the processes we use. So we had to kind of move this forward before the end of the year. So thankfully, that went well. The user interface is very, very similar with the upgrade. There was virtually no downtime. We did this over a weekend. We met employees at coffee shops on a Saturday and did upgrades to their laptops. Come Monday morning, they were ready to go and working. So what's exciting about this, guys, again, don't want to get too technical, is a great web client with ImageWrite with this release that we will be able to use for our remote works, you know, workforce in the future. So that's a good thing. All right, then secondly, we did our fall security awareness training. We kicked it off so the first week in December, actually going on right now. Talked to Steve about using Know Before. Works very well for us. I'm happy to say that we are complete except for two employees who are on PTO. So I expect to have that done by next week. All right. The training focused on, you know, what the tactics are, you know, these days for intruders, right? And it kind of focused on being able to identify quickly if you think you have been hacked or if you think somebody is approaching you, what to do. I think that was very, very important. A lot of people don't know what's going on. You know, they don't. And this great one, this one you saw, Steve, was a phone call, somebody impersonating somebody in the company. Person had no idea. And it kind of puts that to the front. You know, we have to kind of look for that. So expect that to be done again by next week. And then lastly, on the third one, I talked about a couple meetings ago, the CAPS design team now has looked at two alternatives for our CAPS system. The first one was a prototype that was just kind of a basic system done by our contract programmer out of Denver, just for us, the team, to kind of see what the program would be like, how it flowed, and what the screens look like. So we looked at that, and then we saw a demo from Claims Express, which is a full-featured, off-the-shelf application that has all the bells and whistles used by some of the other guarantee associations. So we looked at that one, too. So the next steps, just so you know, is we're going to put forward proposals and requirements that we will need to go forward, right? What do we need day one for us to do our job? So we're going to put that together and then apply that to those two applications to start with, make sure they fulfill that. And then we'll also maybe look at one more, you know, alternative. and then, you know, come back to the board and say, you know, we think of these three or two, here's what we suggest with all the costs involved.
Of the two you've looked at, does one stand out as better that you guys like to use?
Well, Claims Express does, because Claims Express is full featured, so we were able to see it actually work, right? We were able to see them set reserves and do notes, and just great. Really, really feature rich. I mean, you know, really, really good. The prototype is difficult. You kind of have to, you know, kind of think about how what the screens would look like.
That's so all vaporware.
Pardon me?
Vaporware.
Correct. So that's what we think. We want to maybe get one more at the NCIGF conference in November. Spoke to a couple, you know, other GAs that have another system that they use. So that's something that we probably kind of take a look at in, you know, January. Maybe we can do something to kind of bring it.
So Gary, can you tell them how long we've been using, this is CAP, this is a claim system he's speaking of. Can you tell them how long we've been using the current system and what's your, you know, ETA for switching over if that's what is decided?
We have UpCats for about, I think it's about 12 years. I'll go back and make sure. It's been so long. It's been a while. Just to give you an example, for the Claims Express, their conversion time frame, 6 to 8 months. That's what it's going to take. Because it's a matter of taking our data and kind of moving it to the cloud and then converting everything. In the prototype one, if it's done internally by our contract programmer, guess what? It's our data, right? We get to keep it. Right? There's a couple, a little bit of tweaks to it, but that's great. That's a good thing. So as you're going to see, whatever we look at, we're going to have, you know, pluses and minuses, right? We have to look and see what's good and what's bad and kind of weigh them. But that's the difference. The internal one, it's comfortable to us guys because it's our data, we know it well. We can touch it, right? The Claims Express one, it will go to the cloud. That's what everybody's going to the cloud. It will go up there. So that's going to take a while for us to do that. Okay?
Well, I assume, and that's on the committee, right? Or
I'm not, but my users are.
Okay.
So yeah, this is a great shopping. This is a great question. What we did, the committee, we comprised of employees from all areas. We did claims, we did, you know, customer service, we have finance, we have everybody. So everybody gets a say, you know? Absolutely. Thank you. Great question. Okay? Questions, anybody? Okay.
Thank you. All right, so that moves us on to item four, which is our other lines assessment for $75 million. When we had our finance and audit meeting, so the packet for our meeting was prepared, then we had the committee meeting, and we had collected, there was still about $14.3 outstanding, but we were down to about half of that. So I'm going to look to John and say, where are we today? Have we collected it all?
Well, I just want to correct what you said there. The largest outstanding numbers represented 14.3.
Yeah.
But at the time we had, at the time of our meeting, we had 31.7 million still due. As of yesterday, we were just under 14 million that's due to us. I'm disappointed to say, and I'm happy to say that none of the industry representatives here have to worry their so that's good. But I'm disappointed that there are some large entities that have not paid yet. We're working through follow-up procedures with them. There's been a little dissension with regard to what's other lines, and really the definition of other lines is everything you write that's not auto and workers' comp is other lines. So just take those out, and that's the answer. So there's been some dissension there. The dissension's been with Farmers Insurance Group, Nationwide, AIG, FM Global, Progressive, and Sompo.
You say dissension, you mean that they don't
dissension, I mean, we've had to literally, they've not agreed with it, but they now understand that it's due and that they need to pay the amount. They understand how it's calculated and has to be done.
So if they don't pay, what are the procedures to
Yeah, we need to contact TDI, and if they don't pay, they're shut off from running business in Texas until they pay us.
Well, that is an option.
Yeah, it's not, yeah.
That's a nuclear option.
Yeah, it is a nuclear option. And they certainly are aware of it. These amounts are large enough that they have to be wired, so there's not like an issue waiting on check to show up. They can just wire it today, we'll get it by tomorrow.
But you're charging them interest, aren't you, John?
As of late, we're not, but if we get you know, beyond the end of this month, then we're going to have to do something like that. We're giving up like a race.
This was due
December 1st.
December 1st.
Is there a policy specific to that about late charges or not?
We don't have a policy per se, and we've been graceful about it because part of the issue was it's been a paper process where letters have gone out to physical addresses, and in the course of this assessment, we've been able to garner electronic documentation to simplify it. So we're giving them kind of the benefit of the doubt that the document shows up to the annual statement. Contact person might be getting moved around the company and there's contact information, so we're giving them a little grace.
There's no one though who has said we have not received this.
No, we've not received it.
They're challenging. Yeah, and I want to check the...
They've also challenged, everybody knows when you're talking about millions of dollars and a percentage, if you go out 5 decimal points versus 8 decimal points, the 8 decimal points is going to be a lower number perhaps than the 5 because you're rounding up. And so there's been some argument there too, but bottom line is this is where we calculate it. And this amount we have.
What was the due date? November 30th.
Yeah, November 30th.
And I'm going to check the statute, but I believe there's a provision for...
For interest?
For late payment.
So are they challenged in writing, or is it all verbal?
It's a combination. Like Nationwide, as an example, earlier this week was, you know, arguing about. Now, first of all, they received the bill, okay, with the opportunity to argue the balance due. They never contacted us with regard to that balance. They waited for us to contact them and say, where's our money? So they could, you know, they should have contacted us and said, we got a problem with this. They didn't. They waited for us to call them, you know, putting our hand out for our money.
And their response was, we don't agree with the amount we've been assessed.
Because they believe that other lines is not everything that's not workers' comp and auto. And that's the strict.
But that's what's in the statute.
Exactly.
Okay. So when you say now everyone understands, are you expecting the payments?
We should, based on the follow-up procedures that we did over the next week, we should collect nearly 10 million of the just shy of 14 million that's due.
What's the 4 million you're not expecting to collect?
We're going to collect it. I got to go to the run to make sure on that, what they're comprised of. But they're a lot, suffice to say, they're smaller entities, smaller groups.
I'm surprised because there's big names that you've
presented.
I'll be honest, I'm surprised at the names, but I'm also not surprised that it's been more difficult to collect this because insurers are really hurting right now. I mean, I know we say it's a drop in the bucket to some of these insurers, right. But when you see their combined ratios right now, they're really bad.
I had an insurance company reach out to me, and they were arguing rounding, and we were talking $900. And my internal response was, we wasted more than $900 with this back and forth and everything, but to argue $900 was just like,
that I think that shows how
difficult. They're getting pushed down from their folks, and they're saying, you know, it's wrong. $900 here, $900 there, and all that stuff.
So, is there a procedure of when we do send them to TDI? Because from what I'm hearing, if companies are strapped like that and they find out that they're not having to pay it, other ones that are paying it, when there's the next one, it's like nobody pays it, you know. But
statutorily, they have.
That's the nuclear option. We're going to take away the C of A of every company in Texas.
If by the end of the month we don't, we're going to have to take that option, and then we've got to follow up to find out how we address the interest payable to us for being late.
Well, here, I'll just read you. Section 462.016, penalty for failure to pay assessments or comply with the plan of operation. But if they don't pay their assessment, the commissioner shall
suspend, or revoke after notice and hearing the certificate of authority to engage in the business of insurance in this state of a member insurer that, one, fails to pay an assessment at the time the assessment is due. As an alternative to action under subsection A that I just read you, the commissioner may assess a fine on a member insurer that fails to pay an assessment at the time the assessment is due. The fine may not exceed the lesser of 5% of the unpaid assessment, or $100 per month. So, again, there's not in the statute, David, if you haven't paid, I think there's some leeway. I can tell you there was a dispute on the life side, and at the time we had a different commissioner, that was the predecessor to the current commissioner, and he said, it says after a hearing, we don't really have a hearing process, you come, you know, recalcitrant company and Life Guarantee Association work it out, and a settlement was reached. But I don't think, you know, these are major insurance companies. They're not going to want to be this going to
the
mud. Yeah. So I think, though, that maybe there should be a policy on, you know, charging interest for late assessments because the life side definitely does that. It's kind of like, well, you can continue to argue, but you're accruing interest, and if your final decision is we're not paying this, then we're going to tell the commissioner that you're not going to pay it, and we'll see what.
So the interest amount, I mean, this is just dollars and cents. It should be significant enough that it's not encouraged to pay late.
Yeah.
It should be greater than the earnings potential of that money.
Well, yeah. I don't think $100 for that company, because $3.9 million is
I mean, 1%, yeah. 1% a month or 12% annually seems like the way
that's
to go.
That's kind of
same. Yeah.
So, but you may tell them, well, we're, you know, preparing letters to the commissioner, you know, that you have to pay, and that might happen.
I was just wondering if they could be trying to, they're speeding, they're slow playing. Because if they pay in January, does that help with their budget?
Well,
it could.
Technically speaking, they know about it, and GAAP indicates that if you know, if it's known,
yeah, that's how we have figured that might
come. You have to report it as a liability.
But so they use GAAP, not GAAP, right?
Well, they're gonna have GAAP. Everything's gonna be done on a GAAP basis, but they're statutorily filed. Financial statements, which are not that different than GAAP, and it's still like measurable and known to measurable. So,
but it might be a liquidity issue. You know, yeah, there's maybe not. We don't want to sell our bonds or something.
Litigation and we're in dispute, but they don't have any likelihood of questions.
I also kind of looking at the flip side. If you know you're going to have a combined ratio that's well over 100. Going up a tenth of a...
It's nothing.
Yeah.
It's nothing.
So I know one of the things y'all were doing through the correspondence on the assessment was to try to get electronic contact info. How did that go?
And that's going fairly well. It's not, it's definitely not 100%. From a percentage standpoint, the way it's coming through, it's probably only about 15 to 20%.
Sorry. For electronic?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. We thought it was going to be a barrage of, you know, getting them on through, and then it's not. Yeah. And that's going to be kind of the post-mortem to this is, you know, getting that database put together. And obviously getting the form letters out in the future would be pretty simple, because we have the ability to do that with the database and the board documents.
And I know the bigger companies will pay their assessment. My deal was more like the smaller ones. If we're trying to go from the CDI angle, I know I was on that angle where I actually had to make phone calls to companies that were delinquent on their assessment. And so a lot of times you have an accounting department or somebody, you know, haggling $900 and you call somebody else that is above them, saying, hey, you know, y'all haven't paid the assessment. the heckling stops usually because they don't want to. So I do think it would help. And not the bigger ones are not right now or whatever, but down the road, if you got one that's really not paying it, then I would really.
Some of the
smaller companies.
So some of the smaller ones, the smaller entities, what they're concerned about is, you know, we're hearing everything in the media today about wire fraud. Like you buy a house today, it's like, make sure that the wiring instructions are legit before you send the money and yada, yada, yada. Well, they're not only are they concerned about wiring instructions for those greater than 500K, those below 500K are concerned, why are we sending it to a P.O. box in Dallas? Can we just send it to your office? And of course, we're going to say, yeah, sure, send it to our office. Not a problem. We want to get it sooner rather than later, so not a problem. So there's that piece of it.
Yeah, but I get that, but they're still pretty late here.
Oh, no, they are.
I mean, that's...
No, they are. Yep. Yep. And go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, I was just noticing the last time the other lines was assessed was in 2006. And I was just wondering if there was any history of people disagreeing with what the statute said back then.
We can go back and look. That predates most of us. And again, that was all paid. That was a paper exercise then too. So I think the methodology they took at that point was get them out to the annual statement contacts.
Yeah.
We were more of a paper society in six.
Retention monsters might have gotten that.
Yeah. A lot of assessment.
Yeah.
It was 50 million, so it wasn't a whole.
It was pretty big for that time.
Yeah. And then the second issue I had is this $100 fee. I mean, is there any ideas of going and trying to change that at the legislative level?
Yeah, we just said we're adding it to the list.
Okay, yeah. Great.
I agree with John. I think it should be something substantial enough that when you've got 3.9 million that you're slow playing, that'll be significant.
Be charged interest. It's not fair to the other companies who pay you.
Insurance company has to refund money to an insurer for, you know, miscalculation or whatever it is. We pay pretty substantial interest in taxes.
That's right.
So maybe they could sync it up with that statute.
But I mean, you know, we're thinking about the policyholders. These claims have to be paid, and if we're short.
I agree.
Okay. Just FYI, Texas Department of Banking, they just take the money. I sent you a notice that we're going to take this. Even so is the FDIC.
I wish we had the ability.
You don't have to worry about a wire transfer.
No, it just disappears.
Marcia can do that. All right. So there's the latest update. John, I would like for you, like at the end of 30 days past the due date here, so you might be on PTO, so when you get back to PTO, give us an update on what has not been paid.
Of
so
course.
How much is outstanding, as well as who are those companies?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Happy to do it.
All right. That brings us to item 5, the historical assessment data. Really, nothing has changed here. Just shows our last two assessments of $55 million in 21 and for auto and $75 million for other in 22. You know, we'll continue to watch this over the next year. If any more insolvencies come in, then you know we'll have to reevaluate. And so, just a reminder, we do assess for what is known, not for what might be coming. Yeah. 5-year cash flow statements, it has been updated in attachment F to include our assessment of $75 million. And so it's up there on the screen. You see, this does put us in a good position. So assuming we collect the full $75 million, which we should, we don't have any lines at this moment where we need to make any assessments or any recommendations. So this has helped us significantly. And then item seven, we have our Lower Trust Fund Strategy Report, and we turn that over to you, Doc.
So I'm just wondering, you can just stick with the words.
Yeah, I would just stick with.
Yeah, everybody's got their attachment sheet, which is the quarterly fund strategy report. Bottom line, not very much has changed. You know, our investment policies remain the same. You've got a lot of limits with regard to earning a return on our investments based on that policy. We've got the two money managers, Royal Bank of Canada and Hayden & Riegel, who basically equally share the portfolio. They vary in various ways with regard to their exposure, but you know, the types of products are generally the same. You can scroll to the next page. The durations, and something that I mentioned in the Finance and Audit Committee, is that the good news is that our durations are under 4 years. So as those policies come to maturity, or those investment vehicles, excuse me, bonds, come to maturity, we can go out to the market and get some higher return products out there. We are essentially above the market index that we're comparing ourselves to in most instances. It's not an exciting story as far as returns, but there again, we have nothing to do with I was just going to say FDX. So we need to be in.
Correct me if I'm wrong here, but statutorily we can't do anything.
No.
Okay.
Nothing.
Yeah.
So there's, I mean, one thing that we should, I mean, three years ago we were talking about ways of increasing our investment income and looking at alternatives and perhaps changing our investment policy. Because of the nature of high interest rate environment, we're good to go, really. So there's really not really much to do there. Any questions on the Northern Trust custodial report? Okay.
So are you ever in a position where you have to liquidate the liquidity?
We do have to from time to time. In particular, you know, talking about the UBP checks that were having to be processed, millions and millions of dollars, we've had to do some liquidations, and we do them in small tranches with each of the money managers, and get those dispersed into the accounts, but in smaller tranches.
So you are suffering some losses then in those liquidations?
In some cases, but we do them in small tranches, yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, we do have to realize some losses.
Yeah, absolutely. The last section, you want me to just do the variance?
Yes, you want, I know what's in the board book though, so under section 8, that is through September.
Yeah.
So John and I have talked recently through, like, actually, you know, and so it has changed, so if you do want to cover that, that'd be great.
Yep, so, yeah, so this would be present in the financial statements that were circulated for September. We just circulated some a week and a half ago for October. The November we're working on those now. Generally speaking, we are below budget by a slight amount. As we progress through the year, there are a few items that do pop, and we're going to be slightly over budget, I think by like 0.1% or so.
Okay, so it's better than our discussion the other day.
Yeah. Okay. So it's a good position. Some of the items that we had, obviously there were unknowns. Some of it was ITM looking to Gary, and it was necessary. But all in all, it's seemingly working out okay.
The two line items we're over by the most at year end are salaries and computer systems.
Right. And on the salary side, because I saw that myself, and the good news on the salary side is when you combine all the salary dollars, so if y'all were to, can you go to attachment A? And this is just the budget. Just one thing to be mindful of. When we look at the people cost is really lines 1 through 5. So when I showed you the actual budget of 22 versus our projection for 22, when you put those four lines together, we're off by like $11,000. So That was delightful. And part of the reason for that is that when we look at things like retirement and other benefits, not everybody participates at the full extent possible, but as long as they've worked with the association for 6 months or greater, they can opt in or out at any point in time. So you might have someone who has not participated for the year and then suddenly they decide to participate later in the year. So they have that opportunity. So we need to budget at a higher level. We have to budget for it.
Yeah. I think we had a lot of new employees too last year where not contributing, but it was in our budget too. So that helps.
Right. It does. And some of those newer people are, you know, lower paid employees that unfortunately can't afford to give up their monthly salary for investments at this point. That does it on
that's
the variance. That's all I wrote.
All right. We're good with you, okay. And we're gonna move on to item number three, executive session part two. And the time is now 11:44. And the board will adjourn to closed executive session to discuss and deliberate on personnel matters involving the interim executive director and the replacement of the retiring executive director on a permanent basis, as authorized by section 551.074 of the Texas Government Code, and to consult with the general counsel and receive legal advice as necessary on issues arising out of the Texas Open Meetings Act and any agenda items as authorized by section 551.071 of the Texas Government Code.
Okay,
I'm gonna start.
Yes.
Okay, good to go. All right, the time is now 12:48. And the Board of Directors of the Texas Property and Casualty Insurance Guarantee Association are back in open session. We're going to take up item number eight, which is consideration and possible action on matters discussed in executive session. And primarily that item is the compensation of the interim executive director. Do I have a motion?
Yes. So I move that in consideration for taking on the role of interim executive director of TPSIGA, effective as of December 1st, Sean Giannotto shall receive from TPSIGA $1,000 per month for so long as he serves as interim executive director. This compensation shall be a separate payment in addition to his salary for serving as the chief financial officer of TPSIGA.
Is there a second?
Second.
Steve Lynn seconds. Any discussion or questions? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition or abstention? Hearing none, the motion carries unanimously. We will now move on to item number nine, which is public comment. And since there are no members of the public present, we have nothing to discuss there. Now we'll move on to item number 10, and for a highly privileged motion to adjourn.
I'll move.
So move lunch.
So that was the motion by David Nardecchia, second by Larry Bruni. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
The motion carries unanimously, and the board stands adjourned at 12:49.
You know, I'm not here for minutes.
The time is now 1:29 p.m. and the Board of Directors of the Texas Property and Casualty Insurance Guarantee Association is reopening our meeting into open session. And we will now adjourn into closed executive session to discuss and deliberate on personnel matters involving the interim executive director and the replacement candidates for the retiring executive director on a permanent basis, as authorized by section 551.074 of the Texas Government Code, and to consult with the general counsel and receive legal advice as necessary on issues arising out of the Texas Open Meetings Act and any agenda items as authorized by section 551.071 of the Texas Government Code. The time is now 2:33 p.m. and the Board of Directors of the Texas Property and Casualty Insurance Guarantee Association is back in open session. We will revisit item eight, consideration and possible action on matters discussed in executive session pertaining to personnel matters involving the interim executive director. Do I have a motion?
Yes. Okay. In light of John DiMato's resignation as the interim executive director, the board appoints Shelby Betts to fill this role temporarily. The board has authorized individual board members to assist Ms. Betts as needed to discharge the responsibilities of the interim executive director position. Ms. Betts and the board members assisting her shall be reimbursed for any reasonable and customary expenses incurred while performing these services. Is there a second?
Second.
Steve Holt seconds. Any questions or discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition or abstention? Hearing none, the motion carries unanimously. And I will note for the record that Director Steve
Flynn,
thank you, had to leave. So currently we have six board members were here for that vote. With that being said, I just am looking for a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second. Larry Grady moves, Tiffany Ryder seconds.
What time's your line?
No. At 2:35, the board stands adjourned.
Sorry.